Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Before we start the podcast, I wanted to share a brief message from a recent member of Basketball Immersion. They wrote, I want to express my thanks to you for opening my eyes to a different way of teaching the game that I love so dearly. I joined in part to support the podcast work you do, as I know you put in countless hours. But I could have never imagined the depth of the website, the passion of your membership community to collaborate, and the impact it has made on how I coach. It's been an incredible experience for me, and I thank you. It was an incredible email to receive. And as your season starts, I would love for you, too, to join our Basketball Immersion community, not just in support of this podcast, but also in support of your coaching. Go to basketballimmersion.com to sign up.
Coach, it's great to have Ross McMahon's with us. Most recently was player development with the New York Knicks and previously with the Sacramento Kings as well in that role, and various roles through the G League, head coach in the New Zealand NBL, where he was coach of the year one year, and assistant coach with New Zealand's national team, and currently an assistant coach with Melbourne United in the NBL. Welcome to the podcast, Ross.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Great journey, and I encourage people to check out bio and just check out the background a little bit. American-born, but by and large spent a lot of your youth and years in New Zealand. And let's first off talk about the blend of all these different philosophies that have come together for you, because you spent some time in Europe as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of touched a lot of different leagues in a lot of different places. I've been wanting to coach since I was 10, 11 years old as a basketball junkie, but first professional experience was with the New Zealand Breakers as a basketball intern right out of high school. And then from there, got into training business, working with different NBA players from a player development standpoint. And then actually was in Europe for a short time working with Virtus Roma over there, and then came back and jumped on with the Sacramento Kings and G League and NBA and back to New Zealand and now Australia since then. So a little bit all over the place.
Well-traveled. And we're going to talk a little bit of New Zealand Tall Blacks basketball, but also just general philosophy and your philosophies in particular, which I think people are going to be excited to hear about. But let's jump into it. Offensive advantage pie chart, how you choose what to run. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so that's one thing, like I've any offensive possession, obviously, as a coach, you're trying to discern what's the best possible way on every time your team gets the ball to gain an advantage. And by gaining an advantage, meaning to put your team in a position of what I would call dominoes. So dominoes meaning like the point of a closeout occurring, where now whatever set play you call is off. It's now we're just driving and kicking and spacing our way to turning a decent shot into a great shot for us. And so basically that offensive advantage pie chart would be four categories: offensive system, offensive personnel, opponents' coverages, and opponents' personnel. And so the offensive system part, first for me, comprises of what I would call the habits package. Habits package would comprise of kind of just, if you roll the ball out in a pickup game, let people play uncoached, naturally, transition would occur. Naturally, dominoes would occur, just straight drive and kick basketball with an advantage. Pick and rolls would occur and post-ups would occur. And so your offensive system kind of comprises of how you build those habits, how you may play in transition, whether that's a free system or a scripted running system, the different spacings of ball screens you play out of. With like, take Golden State, part of their offensive system for a long time was playing through the post into split cuts, triangle offense. That may be an offensive system. And then shifting to the next part, you would have offensive personnel, which you look at, you make an evaluation of who you have on your team, and that may deem how you choose to add different sets into your offense. So you have a certain specific talent, and that's going to have you gear certain parts of your playbook to that guy if he's someone who can consistently put your team into dominoes based on the advantage he can create, right?
So dominoes is essentially play after the play, or you've created advantage, big or small advantage, and then again, you've got them in the blender, you've got them at a disadvantage, so you're keeping the ball moving either through penetration or ball movement. Correct?
Exactly. And so, yeah, three tenets of dominoes. Once we're in it, when it's like a huge part of this is training your team to all recognize at one value that all we are running this offensive possession for from the moment we get it is to try to reach that point where we create that advantage. Number two, having the recognition to see it. So a player doesn't have a closeout to attack and all of a sudden we have our five men sprinting into a ball screen and crowding his space at that same time. So having a recognition for when it's occurred. And then once we're in it, like rule number one, ball don't stop. It's got to keep moving. We have to have first touch decisions. It's something we talk about a lot. Like it's first touch is a soccer term, but it's understanding what you're doing with the ball before it hits your hands. Basically, as soon as it's hit your hands, you're shooting, you're driving, you're passing to keep that advantage going, keep the dominoes falling. Rule number two, one can't guard two, which really comprises of all your cutting and like short spacing reads that you may make once you're in penetrate and pitch sort of actions. So baseline drive, corner drift to not allow one defender to guard two with tight spacing. A lot of teams, like you have a corner and a wing on the backside, right? Low man gets engaged on the drive and that high wing has to drop to take two. He has to cover two. I call that the take two guy. And so if you're going by the one can't guard two rule, what's the best way now that we can not allow that one guy to guard two? Either that wing's got to cut to the rim to put him in a tough position, or he's got to lift to the top to stretch out the distance that he's got to cover. And so that rule to me comprises of a lot of the little spacing reads you make in dominoes. And then the third rule, into space, out to space. Once you drive or cut into that space in the paint, how quick can you rocket out to space so the next guy can make a play?
The recognition to see it occur strikes me as such an important one, and one that obviously young players struggle with. Is there something that you found that particularly leads to increasing that recognition, improving their ability to be able to make decisions in that recognition?
Yeah, one of the most basic drills that we'll do just to drill dominoes is we'll do just a 4-on-4 drill, four defenders starting in the paint. And ball's thrown to any one of the perimeter players. Rule is you can't give up a three on the first pass. So perimeter guys, as long as they can get a clean in-rhythm three, make or miss, drill resets. So it automatically puts the defense in a position where they have to long close out. And so you're going to have low-by drives. And so off of that, you're putting your offense in a position where every time, relentlessly, they're getting domino situations. So that's very, very easy for them to recognize, obviously. And then from there, there's different progressions that we'll do to start building the recognition of that moment of when that closeout is triggered. So different progressions we'll do.
It's great stuff. And we're going to get into some of the specific situations with Tall Blacks, since I think a number of people would have watched them most recently, obviously in the World Cup. But let's get into the offensive system. So selecting the system, you've figured out a little bit of you figured out your personnel, you figured out this pie chart where you think some advantages are going to come or who can create advantages. How does that then lead to the offensive system?
Yeah, to finish off that pie chart. So we had offensive system, offensive personnel, who you have opponents' coverages going into any given game, looking at, all right, this is a blitz team. If we deem ourselves good enough attacking versus, that's a basically put on a platter, dominoes opportunity for us there. If we can hit the short roll or we can move it on quick. And then the fourth one, opponents' personnel. They may have certain guys that you can pick on, certain players you can pick on that create those dominoes advantages for you. And so for us, going into this tour, with going into the World Cup with the Tall Blacks and looking at our roster, we were put in a position with the group we had to say, all right, we have Greece in our pool, we have Brazil in our pool, we have Montenegro in our pool. Three very talented teams. Greece in particular, a team that's obviously had Giannis, but also had guys like Sloukas and Kalaitis that are elite in ball screens and all really good half-court execution teams. And so is how are we really going to be able to say we can put ourselves in a position to beat these teams by if we're just playing the same game as they are? Where's our advantage going to lie? And so where our offensive personnel, we had a few guys and Corey Webster and Isaac Fotu who presented some real clear opportunities for us. What we really looked at was more, we have to do something systematically as a group that raises our ability to create an advantage on any given possession. And that's where we started to look at, can we be a transition team? Can we be a fast-paced team? Can we be a team that is searching out advantages from the moment the ball touches our hands, not starting at the 16-second point on the shot clock?
I don't know the pace numbers, and I didn't know where to find them. So you can share some of that if you know them in terms of the World Cup and how fast you guys played. The one thing that I did notice in terms of pace, and I assumed you played fast, was that you seemed to be even pushing the ball when there was no pressure, say, on dead ball situations. You were trying to get into the offense fast and try and get to the movement quickly. So were you guys one of the fastest paced teams?
Yeah, I believe we were the fastest paced teams. I don't have the exact pace numbers with me right now. We ended up leading the World Cup in scoring. The balance of our pace kind of progressed as we went through it from camp through preparation games into the World Cup. And I think we ended up kind of finding it the balance that we wanted for ourselves. And the biggest thing for us, I think where we got some of the stuff right early on was in our introduction phase in camp, where a lot of times there's a tendency to jump to introducing sets, or a tendency to jump to even introducing specific transition spacing spots that each position needs to run to. And for us, like the very first offensive talk that we did in camp this year was actually a setup of a drill. And so it was a setup of a drill, this basic line drill where you have five across the baseline and five across the free throw line. Then instead of leaving it at that, where it's normally ball hits a guy and one person has to touch a baseline, we took two players or one player, we changed it up, one or two players off the offensive line, and put them on the same line as the defense. And so they already had an advantage to be able to take off and sprint as soon as we threw the ball to a player on the baseline. We would then call the player's name. That defender would have to go touch the line. And so going down, not only did you have the natural 5-on-4 advantage, but you had one or two guys on the line who were taking off sprinting already. So you're encouraging right off the bat the sprints, which is the biggest part of being able to get out and run, obviously. We laid just basic rules down. So our three tenets of just our transition reaction were: ball changes hands, sprint. Number two, find the nearest sideline unless you have an opportunity to get behind the defense. And that was 1 through 5 for us. So we just wanted to clear that freeway in the middle of the floor as much as possible for the ball handler and give them as clear of a snapshot as possible. And then number three was stay with your spacing. So once we didn't want to cross the floor just to get to the right corner. So if we had three guys running the left side and the ball's on the right side, we're not going to cross the guy through to that corner and muddle that ball handler snapshot. The space he sees is the space we want to play with a lot of the time. So those are our basic just reaction rules to get in the ball. And then we kind of, from there, the next set of rules for us were our mindset of what we're searching out. And running teams aren't great at running because they run to specific spacings. They're great at running because they create outnumbered situations relentlessly more than other teams. So they create more 4-on-2s, more 3-on-2s by being lag free in their reaction. So number one, how many outnumbered situations could we create by running? Number two, how many mismatched situations could we create by running? Because we're playing at such a pace that other teams start saying, trying to find the right matchup rather than just finding the nearest guy. And then number three, once a team is matched up, if they find the right player and there's no mismatch on the floor, now starting to discuss what are some different triggers that we can have in our offense to find dominoes.
Before we get to the triggers, let's go back a little bit, because my understanding from reading a little bit of the background, this was different for this team too. This isn't traditionally how Coach played. Is that fair?
This was brand new, and we've been a pretty heavy execution team for years. So
more defensive focused, and not saying you weren't, but more defensive focused than offensive pace focused, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. So what were some of the things that helped you sell this to the team, or what were some of the factors that led to the team buying in? Because clearly there was buy-in.
Yeah, and so I think the immediate reaction, like I said, from going from usually introducing different 5-on-0 sets and going through our different packages, the first talk of offense being, this is the drill we're in right now, here's basic rules. And then we put in a basic scoring system. The threes are worth three, paint is worth three, and mid is worth one. We didn't say mid-range jumpers, but as it is, players kind of get the message when you put that tall on and play from that standpoint. And we had X's on the floor. We wanted to play five out for the most part. And it was a little wild to start, but right away you saw the willingness of people to get out and play with pace and some of the good things that came from it. And we all, another rule for us was nearest guy inbounded. So we didn't have a designated inbounder. It wasn't four-man inbound every time. It wasn't five-man. It was the nearest guy. Sometimes that may be the one if he grabbed it out the net. But just it was an absolute collective urgency to get it out and go.
I was going to ask you that. And then the other part is, I know people will ask this in advance. So a player was running wide unless they had an obvious middle advantage, or was there no middle?
Yeah, basically is if you had an opportunity to get behind the defense,
yep,
where you could run on the rim, that was an opportunity. And that's 1 through 5 there. And so basically our reasons for you to enter the paint were you have an opportunity to drive in there. That's obviously a reason to go there. Number two, or you have a chance to get behind the defense, whether that's running in transition or we're in the half court and you have a chance to cut behind the defense, be an opportunity. And then number three, you have a mismatch. So 1 through 5, you come down the floor, and this is where you go through film and you have more discussions with guys to have them understand really what is a mismatch for us. But our four man has a one man on him, and it's Isaac Fotu, who's a great post player for us. He has every opportunity to just go slice right into the middle of the paint, and we're going to play 4 out, 1 in around him now, if that's a good enough mismatch for us. But it was those three reasons to enter the paint. Otherwise, we're just going to flatten the floor. So the first guys down are going to flatten down to the corners. Then the next guys down are going to flatten out as wide as they can to the wings. To the weak side wing, ball has kind of that halfway between sideline and middle slot area, angle down the floor, and then we would have a trailer coming in. And that may be a guard, that may be a big.
Well, it's great stuff, and it's great stuff to revisit and watch getting ready for this podcast. And we're going to talk, I assume, when you say triggers, that's what happened next, right? So were we okay, we're hitting ahead, and if we don't hit ahead, we can go point guard push. And if we don't have point guard push, then there's certain triggers. Is that what you mean by the triggers?
Yeah, so the way we built it up is we did our line drill to start off with, and that was a 3-possession game. So obviously on the first one, you're right away creating outnumbered and mismatch situations. Coming back, there may be some mismatch, some matched up situations every once in a while, an outnumbered one. The next layer we went to, rather than hand feeding the players the specific triggers we wanted, we kind of wanted them to find them organically a little bit so they could have some player ownership over them. So what we did is the next phase of drill that we did is we called it the golden snitch drill. And sadly, we're now at a point that makes me feel a little bit old, where half our guys actually have no idea what that is because they've never read or seen Harry Potter. So
that's amazing. Yeah.
which is amazing. But golden snitch, obviously that little gold ball on the Quidditch match that is constantly running around all over the place. And if you find it, it's a game breaker. It's game over. And so our golden snitch drill was 5-on-5. We do it for 3 possessions up and down the floor, and each team would designate their golden snitch on their own team. So we designate our 2-guard as our golden snitch, and any basket that he scores within 2 bounces of receiving the ball, so it can't be off an ISO, it can't be off of just jacking up a shot, it has to be, for the most part, an assisted basket, it counts for a bonus point. So a 3 in the paint or a 3 from 3 now counts for 4, and a mid counts for 2 in that situation. And so naturally, without asking them or telling them to run any specific actions, naturally players with a certain level of IQ, they started finding different actions to get that guy free, whether it was going into quick dribble handoffs for him to get him a shot behind the 3, whether it was sprinting into ball screens, finding quick pinaways in transition. And then naturally the defense started overreacting to those guys. And so the next phase was that player understanding, well, I don't have to shoot it every time. Me just creating an easy shot for us is better than me trying to jack one up to get the extra bonus point. And so now through film and discussion after it, we were able to pinpoint things that they did on their own organically that we can say, hey, that's what you guys did on this one. We want this as part of our offense. Even though that's something we discussed as a staff ahead of time, now there's a level of player empowerment and belief and buy-in to it that they feel they're in this process of creation with us, which I thought was pretty fun.
Yeah, it's great. Make it seem like their idea and obviously build the buy-in from there. So, and obviously you can manipulate things to make sure some of these things organically appear in non-organic ways. And I'm sure you did that as well. But what's your progression after the golden snitch drill?
So third layer then was then getting into talking how we play out of specific spacings. So defense is matched up, haven't gotten an outnumbered break, haven't gotten a mismatch situation, and we're in our five out spots based on our personnel, how our triggers may look out of those. And so there were kind of three main spacings that we talked about, all five out, assuming there's a guard ball handler with the ball in that slot area. There's guard in the strong side corner and a big in the trail. And then it may be, we may have two guards on the floor on the weak side if we're playing smaller, maybe a big on the guard on the weak side, corner and wing. And so we would discuss our triggers with that. And so we called any handoff a zoom. And so we had corner zooms and trail zooms, which are easy, just quick triggers. We had straight what we called a wide action, which was that trail guy. We always wanted coming down, head on the rim, not giving his answer to the defense early of whether he was going to come into a ball screen or go into a pin, but head on the rim. And then just before he's reaching that top of the arc area, then quickly veering into one or the other. And we kind of, for the most part, wanted to hit more 70% towards the wide pinaways and only 30% towards the drags. One, that was part personnel. We had two point guards that were really good just playing in open space that were speedsters and are hard enough to guard there. And the more we could remove the nail by going away into a pinaway and getting them caught up in that action, the more space they had to play with. And then when they went into the zooms guard to guard, it opened up even more space. If you had a pinaway there and a zoom here, you kind of had two-on-two games going on different sides of the floor in mid-transition. So
just before you go there, if people go watch, you'll see those actions. So a lot of the zooms led to gets or quicks or whatever you call them, dribble hand or handoffs without dribbles afterwards. What did you call them or what was the process there? Because that looked really effective. And, you know, I can see a lot of people obviously moving towards that in basketball.
Right. So zoom for us was a dribble handoff. That's corner dribble handoff. So we, again, guard point ball handler, never trying to give the answer too early. So they're head on the rim selling attack. And then as they're getting to that arc or just inside that arc, veering off into handoffs either way. So it makes it pretty tough to be able to switch because you put the defender in a situation where they're more just in a contain mode than they are trying to communicate, hey, let's guard to guard switch this or whatever coverage you want to get to. And you put the corner defender and the trail defender in more a shrink position rather than them being able to get to the body and prepare for whatever action's coming next. So zooms are our handoffs. What we call gets, which is like a throw and go with a big for the most part, a guard to big throw and go. That happened more off of when we had a big running the strong side sideline. So we didn't have a guard in that, maybe that we had two guards weak side, or we had a guard in the trail, or we got a big ahead of the ball. Obviously, if they had a mismatch, they had an opportunity to post on that. So that would typically be like a corner empty situation with a lead big.
Right, and that turned into kind of like pistols action.
Exactly. Yeah. So those guys always had a get for us is a big pistol, basically. They always had that opportunity to snap back for a big pistol. At the same time, as things went on and we recognized like damn near had 12 guys who we felt very confident shooting threes in. Not 12 lights out shooters, but we had 12 very capable three-point shooters. And so as it went on, we more and more encouraged our bigs a lot of time. They were ahead on that strong side, just to sprint to that strong side corner and leverage their space in there. And we did some guard to big zooms out of the corner where we just got them threes early in the clock. And all of a sudden, versus Montenegro, you got a Nikola Vucevic having a guard a big coming out the corner on a handoff and him being stuck out on the perimeter rather than being able to roam the paint and protect the rim.
The other thing I saw on some of the Pistols actions was you guys would throw it from pretty far away in terms of traditional pistols kind of triggered by crossing half, and you guys would run it higher and wider and in more space often. Is that just organic? That's just where that happened?
That was honestly more organic for us on that one. And that one, the gets with the bigs, that's not something that came in this year. That's something we've been doing for a couple of years now. And so our guys have developed a pretty good feel for it, where our bigs do a pretty good job of sprinting the floor and recognizing like their bigs already ahead of them. They don't have an advantage down the floor and they quick snap back on kind of a hook action for those early kick ahead gets where the guard can run off either direction for a quick hand back. yeah, that's kind of been a read that they've grown to get better and better at.
It's great stuff. And then transition pinaways. And then also it looked like some ball screen actions from variable locations. It wasn't typical trail big drags. It was big in a wide spacing spot coming to set the ball screen from, you know, almost a cross angle, which seemed to cause some issues for the defense. Was that conscious?
Yeah, I would say that happened more as a function of, again, we wanted to limit our drags where the drags happened the most were on corner empties with nobody ahead of the ball there. And so in that situation, we wanted our ball handler to use all that corner empty space, but the nearest, normally the five man to come into a drag on that one, and then we could space opposite. And so sometimes they may be on the other side of the floor and they'd recognize that and run across to get to it on those ones. Those ones we compromise kind of our stay with your spacing rule a little bit, just because sometimes you bring your four into it and they're more of a switchable. Our fours are smaller, so teams are more willing to switch with us. So a lot of time our five was our only real, like from a ball screen perspective, our only ball screen trigger that was going to get them out of a switch coverage. And so that would happen in those situations. But again, more often than not, we wanted that big leveraging his trigger going away from the ball in the pins, going into flares, being spaced in the corner, and now being in an inverted handoff with the guard. Just constantly putting other teams' players in positionally in situations that they're not used to defending. And by not having set spots that our fours and fives had to run to, by them sometimes being in the weak side corner, strong side corner, just based on the spacing they ran with, defensively, you're in a situation where you can't run back in the same D-trans pattern that you're used to. You're constantly in a situation where you're having to locate your guy in different areas of the floor.
What are some of the things that helped you develop the triggers and the decision-making of what trigger to use for your players?
So, yeah, after that golden snitch layer, the next thing we did is we played out of this three-quarter court. And so we would put our offense basically in a line at three-quarter court and defense down on the baseline, facing them, on the opposite baseline, facing them basically matched up. Whoever was going to guard the ball could start just behind half court. And we'd start in one specific spacing. So we may start in a line, guard on the sideline, guard with the ball next to him, big in the trail, guard at the far wing, and then a big next to him. And we'd sprint and we'd hand the guard the ball. We'd sprint into our spots. Defense could then build up the floor. So they're always in a matched up situation, but a little bit softened up like you would be in transition. And we'd just play out of that specific spacing for, say, four possessions straight. And then we'd flip it over. And so they're seeing the same spacing, having to recognize the same triggers over and over again. So in that specific one, with a big in the trail and a guard in the strong side corner, we're looking at our guard-to-guard zooms. We're looking at our big pinaways or sometimes big drags. Then we'd switch it up. Then we put a big in the strong side corner and a guard in the trail. So now we're looking at some of our gets. We're looking at guard to big zooms. We've got a guard in the trail. We may be able to get a big flaring him from the backside. And so we just play out of those specific spacings for a set period of time where they got a feel for what they were looking for from a trigger standpoint. And then we'd throw it back into a random scenario playing live, where they're just grabbing it off the board and now they're having to have the recognition of kind of where are the different players on our team at and how does that impact how we're playing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I'm imagining that there's a mind shift for you as a coaching staff too, in terms of, you know, control versus freedom and this process. And like there's a margin, there's turnovers, there's messy, there's all these different things that maybe you're not used to with this national team. And how hard was it to work through that process as a coaching staff?
Yeah, I think that was pretty tough. But at the same time, like I think it, one part of it that made this easier is we knew we were in a position going into this thing, playing Greece, playing Brazil, and Montenegro also with some of the talent that they had, that we had to do something different to be able to put ourselves in a position to win these games. And then luckily we came close on some of them. We won a couple. But it was, that makes a difference from the standpoint of being able to handle some of the stakes early on, some of the turnovers early on. Because, you know, like we have to do something different, something extreme here to create the advantage we need as a team. But a large part of it is the growth process. And it was pretty ugly the first game. The first game we played versus Japan, I mean, we went 6 for 36 from three. It wasn't pretty. We lost by 12 to them. I think we had a pretty high amount of turnovers in that game. But it's just relentlessly through film, showing a lot of good examples and going through it, looking at the threes and as a staff first and saying like, hey, can we live with all these? And we looked at it and we were like, well, 34 of the 36, actually, those are great threes for us that we're really, really, really comfortable with as a staff. And then the players needed to hear that because they were uneasy with it. They were like, oh, damn, we shot that many and missed that many. Like, are these good shots for us? And once they heard it from our staff, I think it helped them understand that it was good for us. And one thing that me and Zico, who's been on the podcast before, we're talking about the other day, something that we think is both might be one of the most important things in coaching that we call the coach's clap, which is like, it's the process oriented clap, not the result oriented clap. So it's the one that the players on the bench and then the players on the floor, when they watch back on film, need to see you as a coach as that shot's going up, as that shot's being created and they're choosing to shoot that shot. You're already into your clap. You're already yelling out, hey, that's a hell of a shot, guys. Great possession. The more they feel that, I think the more the buy-in starts to happen rather than it being once that ball goes through the net, they're seeing. And on the other end, defensively, like in our league, it was funny, it kind of applies in our league the other day. I was watching a coach in our league defensively. Their team plays in deep drops and they live with contested mid-range jumpers from behind. Like a lot of the world is growing to do in different ball screen coverages, and they're playing the breakers, and one of the breakers players dribbles into a pull-up. And as he's pulling up for this shot, Big's back in the paint, not contesting at all. He's just covering the rim, not letting the roller get behind him. That coach is mid-clap, going wild on the sideline, turning to his bench, saying, that's what we want. That's great work defensively. And shot goes in, and he continues clapping. And it's like, that part creates, I think, so much buy-in for players when they see that. And I thought, Paulie, especially... Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, that's great. I mean, the coaches clap, and I've heard Zico say it, but I've never heard the explanation like that. So, and again, it's challenging because you're evaluating decisions independent of outcome. And that's so important in this whole process. It's awesome. Coaches clap, players get used to it. Your team seemed like you guys played better basketball throughout the tournament. I know the quality of the opponents early, you guys had a tough schedule early. But you still ended up beating Turkey, right? And then was it Japan at the end in the classification game?
Yeah, so, beat Montenegro, beat Japan, beat Turkey.
Yeah, so if the tournament kept going on, look out, right? And I imagine for this style, that makes sense. That players got more comfortable because they saw more coaches collapse. They saw the reinforcement of how they were playing, and they saw the challenges for the opponent.
Yeah, and one thing that I think we got really good buy-in, but pre-tournament, I think once we got past that initial camp part and that initial Japan game, which was a struggle for us. But one part that was, I think, big for us is we talked about a lot was we talked about what is our handshake to any team that we play with. So anytime just you're walking down the street and you meet someone, obviously you give them a handshake, and there's people you come across that have these really firm handshakes and just other people that just kind of do the stock standard one. But every once in a while, you meet some random person that manipulates the heck out of your hand, and they do something weird and different. Like they may snap your thumb, or like they control the handshake that they want. And that, for me, I know I always walk away like being like, damn, they controlled the hell out of that one. They imposed their will on my hand. It's never a great feeling. It's never a great feeling. But that individual stands out to you. And it, from an offensive standpoint and how we presented ourselves offensively and the way we played the game overall, we wanted to make sure we had a unique handshake and that we dictated that handshake. And so when we went into games versus Montenegro, who play two massive bigs and Vucevic and Dubljevic, who are beasts inside and on the post, we looked at it as like, this is a challenge of handshakes. Who's going to impose their handshake better? And you walk away from the game and you hear Vucevic's quotes in the press afterwards, and it reflected our style of play. And our players heard that and they were hyped about that. And then the next game versus Greece, they don't play their centers versus us. They sit Papayannis and they only play Baroušis 6 minutes that game. And so even though we end up losing that game in a close one, our players walk away from it saying like, damn, we got world-class teams reacting to us, which I think created a lot of buy-in for the group. They enjoyed that.
No, that's great. And I guess the obvious question becomes, how did you define shot selection for players in the context of this system?
Yeah, and again, that was something that obviously we started to address just with scoring systems early in camp with the 3-3-1 scoring system. But we also had some, we have between a couple of our guys in particular, Corey Webster and Tom Abercrombie, are really talented mid-range shooters. It's always been something great for them. And so there was never a point in camp where we said, like, we are not shooting those shots. But we made a point of celebrating the threes that we created. We made a point of celebrating the paint shots that we created. And then inside conversations with Corey and Tom that we had, made a point of making sure that they didn't feel handcuffed. Hey, we're not trying to take this away from you completely, but what we are doing is, Corey, we're empowering you. Like, when you see that big in a drop, we want to set that screen a little bit higher, and we want you to get really good at shooting this pocket jumper from three rather than from two. And we think you can get up 12 threes a game in this system rather than just five. And he was pretty bought into that. And he still shot his mid-range ones when he needed to, but it became more later in the clock because he saw the good ones we could create early in it. There were certain threes that we'd show on film as the thing went on that were tough, off-balance, contested ones early in the clock that we'd have a discussion with about as a team. But overall, the clock wasn't an issue as much as it was just making sure a player was in rhythm and off balance. If those two things were there, we were very comfortable with those shots being taken.
It's good stuff. It's again, it shows how a philosophy and a style of play can merge and again, empower a team with confidence. So it's really good stuff, and I appreciate you sharing this. And the coverage solutions, because let's dive into this a little bit. You already mentioned if they switch. So is that one we can start with? How do we beat a switch?
Yeah, so one thing, I guess, is a mindset for us with that, which was going into facing any coverage as a team, is our mindset as a staff going to be, do we want to kill the coverage or do we want to punish the coverage? And what I mean by that is, take, for instance, the team that's going to blitz, that's going to put two on the ball on a ball screen. Punishing the coverage would mean we're going to run actions that are going to put them in a position to do their coverage. They're going to be able to blitz it. But we're going to make sure we're spaced in a way and make sure we've drilled our players in a way that we're confident that we're going to be able to execute very well versus that coverage. So it's a middle on ball, and we have a good screener who's a short roll decision maker. We're going to find him on the short roll, and we have shooting around him, and we're going to make our reads from there. And that's going to be our way of punishing it. Compared to kill the coverage in that situation would be, what sets as a staff can we script that aren't going to be allow them, that aren't going to allow them to get to that coverage? Or can we screen our five into the action that gets their guy a little bit late? Can we set a back screen with our five that makes their man soften up and then run them into it? So like a good example is, to me, from one playoffs to the next, 2 years ago in the playoffs, Damian Lillard is able to get blitzed by New Orleans relentlessly, and they don't do a good job of punishing the coverage for whatever reason. They weren't able to do it, and they struggle in that series. Whereas you take it to this year, and they play versus those coverages in the playoffs when they came in blitz Dame, and they got better at punishing the coverage, but two, they also added in sets in their action that didn't allow teams to get to a blitz on Dame, where he saw more drops. He saw bigs late coming into that blitz where he had space to get into shooting the ball. And so that was always a discussion as our staff going into any game. What coverage is this team going to play versus us or versus one of our main pick and roll players? And are we confident playing versus it? Or do we need to have a set that manipulates the defense to play the way we want to?
And in a tournament like that, is there less variability in the coverages? Because basically teams get no time to practice, right? Just game day shoot video to try and sort it out. Is there less variability in terms of what you're going to play against?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more I think there's still a pretty good amount of variation from the standpoint of each team has built up their defense how they want to. I mean, for us playing Brazil, they started in drops and then they ended up in hard shows. With Montenegro, they were always in deep drops, and then we played Greece and they were straight switches. In general, with Corey Webster, with the way he played in the lead up games, with the way he was scoring the ball and shooting the ball off ball screens, it was a educated guess that going into the tournament, teams were going to be very aggressive on him. So that they were going to be up blitzing, and they were going to be up aggressive switching. And so we kind of had it able to have a sense of scouting what coverages we were going to see.
So just give us a little bit of a list for coaches. What are some coverage solutions that we should be thinking about?
So for drops, like the Punisher coverage version of that would be finding your way to get your best score in the drop, who's able to hit pull up threes off the pick and roll if they're going to play back, or who's, if he's a great guy, with if he's a great floater guy, or if you have a lob roller and you're very confident being able to make decisions playing versus that. Kill the coverage version of that would be versus drops. What's become really popular would be the Spain action. Being able to back screen the guy on the drop and not allow him to stay playing it as a 2-on-2 game. That generally has teams come out of the drop or have to move their big away from the ball. Playing versus a blitz. The punish the coverage version would be playing versus a short roll on that. Finding the guy in the short roll and playing 4-on-3 behind the action and getting good at cutting the guy from the corner on that. Or it may be moving it quick to a guy on the perimeter for a pass-pass action if your screener is not a great short roller and you want him more diving hard on the rim. The kill the coverage version would be, like I said earlier, maybe screening that guy into it so you get the big late, using him as a back screener to soften his man up, and then running him into it. Yeah, you can go into switches, into unders, into ices. Same deal. There'd be different versions of that for those.
That's awesome. Now, that gives great perspective on kind of how to frame it as a coach and how to approach those two, all the different situations, not just those ones as well. So what were some of the measures that you tracked in terms of the analytics and things that helped you guys, again, support what you were doing or give your team an understanding of what success meant?
Sorry, Chris, before we jump to that, I guess the one other thing I'd say to that coverage conversation, the philosophy around that, is one thing we were always very aware of was is never being a prisoner of the coverage, is what we call it. And so a team is really good at, you've deemed going into a game that this team blitzes and this is going to be a great advantage for us, but it gets into the game and you're not being effective versus the blitzes, and maybe you don't have the sets in your system to be able to stop them from blitzing and kill the coverage. What other actions in your offense can you get to that stop you from being so caught up in the blitzes hurting your ability to score and being able to shift the script from that? A lot of teams with versus Corey Webster with us, like they come out in their drops. He'd come down the floor, he'd hit a few threes versus drops, and now mid-second quarter they'd adjust and they'd start bringing their guy up the floor. If we executed well versus the blitz, then we would stay in it. That was great. If we didn't execute well versus the blitz, now they're taking Corey out of the game and we're not effective using him well enough to take advantage of other guys on the floor. So for us now, we had to shift away from ball screens to get him into other scoring actions that had him not see blitzes. So that became some of the early pins in transition. That became sometimes like a pin down into a handoff action that's harder to blitz. How can you soften up his guy and the guy on the handoff or the guy on the screen so he's not seeing that blitz anymore? So you're not a prisoner of that coverage anymore. That was just another part to it that we were always very wary of.
No, I love the depth of that for sure. And yeah, no, it's just, again, the language, the phrasing, adds a simplicity to it, even though, again, there's definitely depth and complexity to this. But I assume, again, were you framing it this way for your players?
We talked about the kill the coverage, punish the coverage stuff. We talked, yep, obviously, concepts like dominoes and different stuff there. There's always a layer that you go deeper as a staff than you do with the players. You want them to know as least as they need to know, so their minds are free to play, especially with the way we're playing, which is fast and free and instinctual. So there's always a level of information that we want to stop at as far as what we're giving them. But yeah, but, so getting into the...
Yeah, let's talk about the evaluation of it then in terms of the analytics. So talk about that.
The things we tracked, again, we didn't get into a super amount of different things we tracked. And obviously in the NBA, you have your second spectrum stuff and you have access to more stats that you can use. For us, there were just some really base measures that we constantly talked about that helped build our pace in our transition game. Number one was something that we called bolts. And so bolts for us is just defined as a real life sprint. And we just charted that every single game from defense to offense. How often did we get real life sprints from one end to the other and just from one individual? and we chart that as a whole team.
Was that subjective, or what defined that?
For us, that was subjective. So that was
our coach's eye. Yeah.
That was our coach's eye going through it and then showing the examples to the players so they understood what that was. Obviously, one player sprint may be faster than the next. It was something that we put in with the Knicks last year that we were actually able to use some of the second spectrum data to follow on, where that can actually, you can define what a sprint is to the camera and it can pick up what it is. So for like the, for the Atlanta Hawks last year, last season, I think this number is right. If I'm remembering it right, it was 27. They averaged 27 offensive bolts a game by the thing we put in place. And so that was our number that we put down for Tall Blacks for New Zealand that we always wanted to be able to exceed. And so we talked about it all through camp. We went into the first game and we come out of it and we had 8 bolts for that game. And so obviously that was a tough discussion with our group, where we talked about it and discussed it and showed clips of why aren't we sprinting in this situation, or why aren't we having the immediate reaction where we're lag free to get out and go. And then we turned around in the next game and we were at 42. So
that's obviously a huge difference. Yeah.
That's a big difference. And it was, and that became something that we tracked every game. Our number ended up being, could we be above 32 every game? And that was something that we were pretty consistently able to do.
That's great. Well,
getting guys to buy into that. So that was stat number one that we tracked. Number two for the ball handlers was how often we could get the ball below the free throw line extended by 17 seconds on the shot clock. And so that may speak to a lot of the kick aheads that you would see. So whether that's by getting it there off the bounce or by getting it there with a kick ahead, just how often could we shift that defense where they had to flatten below the line? And we thought by doing that, that would always create more opportunities up the floor if we got that ball down the floor quick and we were able to flatten the floor quick with our runners. So that was another major one that we tracked.
That's great. Anything else?
The next ones, we talked a little bit about just percent of total shots in a game from rim and at three. So that spoke to kind of trying to eliminate the mid-range a little bit. Could we be above 85% every game on that, our shots being rim or three? Mm-hmm. And then the last thing was a player evaluation that we did from one game to the next, which was basically just a 1 through 3 rating that every player had to just send in like our little WhatsApp chat post game, which was they had to rate their next play mindset, which was for this one, this again was an offensive rating. So their next play mindset going from defense to offense, how immediately were they able to react to getting the ball out of bounds, nearest guy, getting 1 foot out and then throwing it in to a guy, our guys getting out and sprinting. A huge thing on made baskets for us, we became like kind of one of our calling cries is what we call clapbacks. And so anytime a team scored on us, it was how quick can we clap back? Obviously, someone makes it, you're in a, with a group of friends and someone makes some sort of joke about you or is talking trash, some sort of insult to you, the quicker you can come back at something with them, the more you take the spotlight off of you. So for us, it was how quick can we clap back at the other team? How quick can we seize that moment and take off going the other direction? So that played into our next play mindset often. Number two was rating 1 through 3, just our sprint, like individually.
That was you're saying this, is this self-evaluation they're posting in the WhatsApp or is it?
This is self-evaluation.
Okay. All right.
They would send in a private text to us as a staff individually. Okay.
Yeah.
They would send their next play mindset evaluating themselves. They would send their sprint rating for themselves. They would send, if they were someone who's pushes the ball quite often as a primary ball handler, they would send their rating 1 through 3 on their dribble push. This is how often they felt they were able to get out and push it and create advantages in transition and get it below the free throw line by 17 seconds on the shot clock. And then number four, they would rate the group on how our spacing felt. Just how often did you feel that the snapshot you were seeing was one of space and open paint to attack? And we'd average it out. We'd give that rating to the group the next day. And so just four things that were critical to our offense, obviously, that the team grew to gain an understanding of what does a one feel like? What does a two feel like? What does a three feel like?
And did you find players were harder on themselves generally than coaches would be, or where did that fall in that range?
Yeah, New Zealanders generally have a trend of being a pretty tough on themselves group, I would say. And so in general, they were pretty tough on themselves early on. But on the sprint one, that was one where it was rated probably too high right off the bat, and they had to grow to understand really what that was. So I think where we walked away with after that first game with a 2.3 being really good, one being poor, with a 2.5 average on our sprint from the team, our staff rated it obviously only getting 8 bolts as a one or a 0.5. And so that got the message to them pretty quick, and they started to understand what that felt like.
Well, it makes sense because again, it's new to a lot of them, right? They've never experienced that pace and that understanding. So I guess maybe the biggest adjustment, I'm not sure, but is for some of your traditional bigs. And was that the hardest part for them? Was this the traditional big kind of shifting to this more perimeter-oriented transition spot when not a traditional trail or middle run spot?
That was really tough for a couple of them. And they showed tremendous growth in that through us consistently drilling it. And the film sessions that we did with them and them just growing in their understanding. But more than anything, the toughest read for them was when they were ahead of the ball and recognizing that just because they're ahead of the ball doesn't mean that's a reason for them to run to the paint. It's only if they're ahead of the ball and they have an opportunity to actually get behind the defense. But otherwise, if their man's in front of them, unless that's a smaller person and they have an absolute mismatch and they can go just pin them inside, we wanted them to veer off to the nearest sideline in that situation. And again, give that snapshot of space or veer off into if they're ahead of the ball, normally they're exiting out to one of the corners and they're down the floor that way or snapping back into a get. But that was the toughest read for them, recognizing that, but that cleaned up pretty well. The next part is just as a group, understanding there's a big difference between spacing at the wing, hugging the line compared to spacing wide and stretching the sideline as much as you can. And that's where obviously you see different NBA teams putting their 4-point lines out. Milwaukee Bucks putting different X's on the floor, super wide to really understand the difference of that. And especially on a FIBA court, that's even more of a challenge. You have to be even more disciplined with that. And then the more reps that the bigs got, the more little breakdown drills that we did, the more they grew in that area.
Well, and I guess the follow-up question to that is, did those traditional bigs who struggled with it, did they end up liking it at the end?
Yeah.
I imagine they did, right?
I think they did. I mean, for one of our bigs was a really high-level shooting big. So that played into his hands, and he was really good snapping back into gets and recognizing that stuff. He picked it up pretty quick. One of our other bigs who hadn't shot threes traditionally, but had always been a really high-level 19-foot shooter, enjoyed being empowered to step out just a little bit further. And then he picked up on some of the different screening reads and he grew with that. Our other guy was our foreman, Isaac Fotu, and he's the guy we actually ended up bending our system to a little bit because he was so good inside in the post that we ended up saying, too often early on in our prep games, he was coming out of games, he was with stat lines going 3-for-3 or 4-for-4 or 2-for-2. He's not getting the amount of shots that he needs. So we ended up saying to him, for you, anytime that even if it's the same size guy that you feel you have an advantage versus that guy, we will play around you. And that also ended up being where on free throws by the other team, we ended up compromising running on those and often calling set plays to make sure he got a post touch. And that comes back to the pie chart thing. Of with any given team, that pie chart may look different. You may be geared 60% to offensive system and 20% to personnel and 10% to coverage and a certain percent to opponent's personnel. And with us, where we thought early on we were going to have to be very much huge percent offensive system, just playing through our transition stuff and those early triggers, the more he showed his ability to be a really high level player in the post, even versus the same size guy, the more we said, all right, he's good enough at drawing a double team or being able to score on his own, that we sacrificed a bit of our pie chart there and gave him a bigger chunk of that.
Coach, let's circle back a little bit to the dominoes. I love the phrasing. I love the idea of this. And can you talk about some of the ways, because we talked a little bit about building the team system. Can we talk about a little bit more of the individual piece in terms of the dominoes, creating advantage, keeping advantage, leveraging advantage, and so talk about the ways that you did that.
Yeah, so that was one where we also layered in a lot of decision-making drills, something that you've spoken about and you've done in different clinics that have been really helpful. But just some basic ones, just obviously with, like, we put a ball handler kind of in our slot area, in that attacking area that he's normally coming down in, with a defender on his, starting on his side, almost in like a ice, in a down push position. And then we space different guys, whether we're going 3-on-3 or a lot of time we do this 4-on-4. So we go a weak side corner, a strong side corner, and a weak side wing in that situation. And we play it live from there, basically off, it's live on the offense's first movement. So they'd start with a live bounce and then defense is in recovery. And so automatically putting the low man in a position a lot of the time where he has to come over and rotate, and creating that scenario on the backside where you start to recognize that kind of subtle feel between when does it make sense to stay completely spaced? When does it make sense to, that guy's a little bit deeper on the baseline and that high wing defender started to shift? When does it make sense to cut the take two defender compared to lift up and separate the take two defender? When does it make sense for us, for, so we had a few guys who were just absolute knockdown guys who were 45% shooters from three. We had other ones who were lower. When does it make sense to flare that take two guy? And it become kind of a hammer read on that backside. And so by drilling the heck out of decision-making drills like that, it helped us kind of learn how to operate better out of different domino situations. We'd also often start it in a bad spacing scenario. So we'd do it with the ball handler at the wing with the defender on his hip, kind of pushing him middle in a beat position, but we'd start the next guy almost at the top of the key, a little bit over, nearer to the ball. So his defender was very close in a position to be able to plug on it, where as soon as that drive starts happening middle, if that top guy doesn't immediately start sprinting on his wing drift to honor that one can't guard two rule number two of dominoes, then we're going to be in a really tough place and he's going to be able to plug up that gap. So sometimes we give them good spacing scenarios to play out of in those decision-making drills and sometimes really poor ones.
Love it. Obviously, it's great stuff. And I just got to say it again, what you said about starting bad spacing scenarios. You don't start there, but you get there. And that's such an important part because, as we know, the game doesn't always unfold the way that we map it out in terms of the template. So players have to figure it out. So what a great, great point there that I hope coaches note. And Ross, I mean, I can't thank you enough. I thought this is tremendous, just tremendous information and depth of understanding of how you guys are trying to play. And I'm curious, with Melbourne United, are some of these concepts being used this year?
Little bits and pieces. With this team, this is a different group, and it's also one that I'm coming into as a new guy. They've been a really successful team for a really long time.
Dean Vickerman does a great job. Yeah, great job there.
Dino does an awesome job. They won a championship 2 years ago. They lost in the finals this year. And obviously a lot of Australian guys that have been comfortable playing in Aussie flow action that the Boomers team runs. It's been really successful for them.
Absolutely.
So a little bit more of that stuff going on. But when it comes to the habit stuff, as far as your habits in transition, your reactions in dominoes, your ball screen coverage reactions, to me, those are basic tenets of basketball that you're going to see in any offense, no matter how you play, that often are overlooked for putting in sets first. But it's, can you teach your players to play the best high level type of pickup by drilling the hell out of those situations? And that's what's actually going to make all your set plays and half court actions so much cleaner, and what's going to make you an execution team in the long term.
Ross, can't thank you enough, man. Great stuff, great sharing, and I know you're going to do great things as you keep moving forward in basketball, and we look forward to learning more from you in the future. Thanks for taking the time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Awesome podcast, what you're doing with this and bringing different people in and different sources of knowledge. It's so cool. I've learned so much from it, and yeah, thanks a lot for doing this and having me on.
Awesome. Well, now you're a part of it, so even better. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations,
So connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.